Welcome on into Studio 2. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And my name is Avi Wolfman. Aaron, thanks for joining us today on the radio and on YouTube. Hello to our Studio Tubers. And today we're talking about America's role in the world, focusing first on the conflict in Ukraine, but then zooming out to look at what America's role in the world should be. It certainly seems to be changing under President Trump. Mm-hmm. A world order and an American ally base that was really established at the end of World War II may be falling apart. So we want to know today from you, what do you think about America's foreign policy pivot under Trump? Give us a call, 888-477-9499, or you can email studio2@whyy.org.
Yes, and we have a great panel set up. We'll hear some local reaction from someone from the Ukrainian-American community. We have two experts on foreign policy with opposing views, so definitely we'll hear some diverse viewpoints.
And of course, if you're on YouTube, leave a comment right there in the YouTube chat. So that's all coming up today in the bulk of our show. But as always, we start with a trio of local news stories. Cherry, why don't you start us off?
So after 102 days of no problems, the portal in Love Park was vandalized. And now four suspects are wanted for cutting and stealing copper wire from that live stream portal. Look at that.
What a shame.
Now, if you don't know what the portal is, if you haven't been to Love Park lately, the portal opened in November. It's a live stream video art installation that connects Philadelphia with other cities around the world. There's a webcam on 3-minute loop to cities in Lithuania, Poland, and Ireland. But if you visited in the past few weeks, you probably noticed that it's been wrapped up in blue tarp. And there was a sign on it.
Can't see Ireland, can't see Poland, can't see Lithuania.
And the sign says it's temporarily down for repairs. Well, turns out on February 1st, thieves went after copper wire on that installation. Surveillance video shows around 5:30 in the morning on a Saturday, a suspect cutting the wire. They stuffed it into a trash can and boarded a train. That's some Philly stuff to do right there. And the portal, like I said, had been up for 102 days, much longer than people predicted. Because remember, Avi, we talked about it when it was launched. People thought that Philadelphians would do something gross.
The tyranny of low expectations.
Or lewd, yes. And that it would get shut down. But alas, none of that happened. And instead, thieves swooped in. The good news is, and I'll end it on this before I let you respond,
is
that the portal is coming back.
Yay.
The company, according to 6ABC, has said that it will be moved back to the original spot come Thursday of this week, and that they are upgrading security and they will protect those wires so thieves won't steal them again. Avi, your thoughts?
Oh, my thoughts are I'm sad, and I really was heartened by the fact that this had been able to remain up for so long and that people were well behaved. And I thought it's a great art project. It's a great idea. It only takes a few chuckleheads to ruin a good time for everybody else. That is a universal truth. And it is what happened here. So, you know, hopefully they'll catch them.
Yeah, they have pretty
justice for the portal is the way I feel about
it. Oh, I like that's a good hashtag. Hashtag justice for the portal. And they had fairly clear images of these folks on from the surveillance video. So maybe
the chuckleheads, as I have termed them.
I that is such a funny like word. I laughed. I chuckled a little bit when you said
chuckleheads.
Okay. But
didn't know that's what was going
to
do.
But now, hopefully, if you haven't gone to see the portal, when it comes back, you should go see it.
Okay.
Yeah.
I would love to see it. I did miss it the first time around.
It's pretty cool.
And now you have strengthened my resolve to see it when it's back up. Mm-hmm. Long live the portal. Also, long live the great Chubby Checker. Philadelphia singing legend, grew up in South Philly. You know him for many hits, including, of course, The Twist. And for years, he and his fans have been campaigning to get him rightfully into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Well, finally, yesterday, we learned he has been nominated for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Doesn't mean he's in, but he's on the short list. So Chubby Checker, I believe he should be in. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. I know I'm a homer on this because he's from Philly, but I believe his influence on dance and music is profound. And I believe he belongs in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I'm glad he's one step closer today.
Yeah. And I want to say that this is long overdue. Justice for Chubby Checker.
All right. Today we're all about justice. Portal, Checker, and, got it.
And I got to mention, I did some research, and apparently The Twist, Chubby Checker's famous single, had been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2018. It was one of the first songs to be inducted.
Oh, that's
inducted,
messed up.
But Chubby Checker was not inducted.
That's messed up.
To me, that's problematic. Justice for Chubby Checker.
And I will say this on a more serious note. Mm-hmm. He gets sometimes framed as a one-hit wonder because that hit was so big.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually look at his, you know, his discography, I believe he had 7 top 10 hits. And that one song, The Twist, like there's so few songs that you could look back 60 years later and say, everyone still knows that song.
Yeah.
And can sing that song and can do
and
that
do the dance. Because we were both in here twisting.
We were twisting before the show. And it did inspire really lots of other rock and roll mm-hmm. dances. And we're still living in that legacy today. He absolutely deserves to be in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. He's an icon.
He
and
is.
People still know the name Chubby Checker.
And he's Philly. So, he's know, yeah, we got to go, you know, for Chubby Checker. And our third story today. So the Sixers, they're playing so badly.
Yes.
That tickets are cheap. And when I say cheap, I'm talking about a dollar cheap.
A dollar?
You can get tickets to see the Sixers for a buck. Yes.
Depending on the game,
On the game, yep. And those seats are not good. Don't you're not going to be courtside with that dollar. Okay, you're going to be in the nose.
You're not high fiving the coach.
No, absolutely not. So we here at Studio 2 wanted to help first timers and folks who may not have been to a game in a while go and make sure they have fun. So we came up with a list, and Avi, you've created a title for this list.
Yes. So this is how to go to a Sixers game for dummies, because we figured with these really cheap tickets, people might take advantage of this mm-hmm. and they might want to go to their first Sixers game or their first Sixers game in a while because the team has been competitive for about a decade now, or, you know, not quite, but it's 7 years or so now. So it's been a while since the tickets have been this cheap. All right. So if you are thinking of going to your first Sixers game in a while, here's how to go.
All right. Give it the list. Give the list.
So you might be asking, how should I get there? I would recommend you take the train, the Broad Street line. The parking lot is a mess. And the Broad Street line is pretty efficient. And for Sixers games, it's not nearly as jammed up as for, say, Eagles games, because it's a much smaller venue. So it's a comfortable ride in and out.
I would agree. But if you drive, okay, get there early, and I would recommend at least 45 minutes early. I drove, and then leave before the game is over, or else you will be stuck in the parking lot.
And you might as well, because the result doesn't matter. The Sixers are very bad this year. All right. When you get inside the game, you might be wondering, why is there a blue dog?
I wondered that.
The blue dog is named Franklin. He is the mascot of the Sixers.
Hey, Franklin.
Now, the obvious follow-up is, why is a team called the Philadelphia 76ers employing a blue dog as a mascot? Do you know the answer to that?
I do not. Tell me.
Basically, the backstory is they didn't have a mascot for a while, and they asked a bunch of school children, like in a focus group, what the mascot should be. And this is what the kids came up with, a blue dog called Franklin. Franklin being an allusion, of course, to, you know, Ben Franklin, Franklin Institute, that idea.
He is cute, though.
He's pretty cute.
He can dance.
Back in the day, it was a bunny called Hip Hop, and before that, it was a blue blob called Big Shot.
All right.
When you start watching the game, you might be wondering, where are the good players on the Sixers?
They're not playing.
They're sitting right there on the bench. The reason is because the Sixers have several good players who are injured right now. That is partly why their season has been so disastrous. They also, at this point, have an incentive to lose games because it would help them get a better
draft pick,
potentially, although they might not get a draft pick at all. That's a different story. So look to the bench for your favorite players.
Yes. And now we got to talk about food.
This is important.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be expensive. But what is the best food, Avi?
Well, look, we're going to put an image up here of Shake Shack, which is at the game. There's also Federal Donuts. They have some decent food, but it is overpriced. Unfortunately, you cannot bring your own food into a Sixers game. So I would recommend eating beforehand or afterward.
That is a good one. And let's talk about the bag policy, because this gets a lot of people caught up when they're coming in security. Your bags can only be like 14.5 by 6.5.
Not even.
Not even. 4.5 by 6.5. They're tiny.
If you're going to bring a bag, basically make it microscopic, because you can only bring in a bag that is 4.5 inches by 6.5 inches.
That's
and
tiny.
Yes, they do enforce this.
Yes. And you, if you have a clear bag that's a little larger, they will let you in. I had one.
But basically, don't bring a bag.
Or don't bring a bag. Put stuff in your pocket. And let's talk about the Jumbotron. Everybody wants to get on. What is your recommendation as we wrap up?
If you want to get on the Jumbotron, you either have to be or bring a very cute child who is willing to dance. That is the key to getting on the Jumbotron. It works about half the time. So if you want to be on the Jumbotron, be or bring a child. And bring your curiosity to Studio 2. We'll be right back with much more. And welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Today, we're talking about how President Trump is changing American foreign policy. The war in Ukraine is the starkest example of the whiplash between former President Joe Biden and President Donald Trump, as the U.S. seems to be taking a more isolationist and transactional role.
Things came to a head last week when Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky visited the White House and had a tense exchange in the Oval Office with President Trump and Vice President J.D. Vance.
Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning.
I know.
You're not winning this.
I
You have a damn good chance of coming out okay because of us.
Mr. President, we are staying in our country, staying strong from the very beginning of the war. We've been alone, and we are thankful. I said thanks
in
this cabinet,
and
not only in this cabinet.
We gave you, through this stupid president, $350 billion.
You voted
for your
president.
We gave you military equipment, and your men are brave, but they had to use our military.
What about us?
If you didn't have our military equipment,
you invited me to speak.
If you didn't have our military equipment, this war would have been over in 2 weeks.
In three days. I heard it from Putin. In 3 days. This is something
maybe
new.
Less.
In the days since, the U.S. has paused foreign aid to Ukraine, and the CIA has now stopped sharing intelligence as well. The topic was not a major part of Trump's address to Congress last night, but he did share an update.
Earlier today, I received an important letter from President Zelensky of Ukraine. The letter reads, Ukraine is ready to come to the negotiating table as soon as possible to bring lasting peace closer. Nobody wants peace more than the Ukrainians, he said. My team and I stand ready to work under President Trump's strong leadership to get a peace that lasts. We do really value how much America has done to help Ukraine maintain its sovereignty and independence.
So today on the show, we want to step back and discuss how the United States' role on the world stage is changing. Will Trump's approach strengthen America's interests or weaken them?
With us today are Andrew Filipovich, volunteer with Revive Soldiers Ukraine, and former president of the Ukrainian American Bar Association. Andrew, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We also have Dominic Tierney, professor of political science at Swarthmore College. Thank you for coming in, sir.
My pleasure to be here.
And joining us remotely is Justin Logan, Director of Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Thank you for being here, Justin.
Thank you.
And before we start this conversation for you at home, our question for you is, what do you think about America's foreign policy pivot under Trump? You can call us. The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, drop your comment in the chat.
Andrew, I wanted to start by asking you about your personal experience over this last month or so since President Trump has been in office. There have been so many flashbulb moments. Was there one that struck you in the gut most emotionally as a Ukrainian American?
I think the way President Zelensky was treated in the White House was clearly a gut punch. This is something we never expected. The Ukrainians have been fighting their own battle. They haven't been asking anybody for boots on the ground, but they have been asking for logistical and weapon support. And to see him being belittled in the way he was, I made sure to view the whole video completely. And at no time did I see anything which indicated that the President Zelensky was ungrateful or that he said anything that was insulting or even that he was unwilling to sign the agreement regarding the minerals. And to simply sucker punch him, this is representative of an individual who's drowning. And you're looking at him, you're laughing at him, you're mocking him, you're not throwing him a lifeline. In fact, you're pulling back on the lifeline. And this morning, probably the worst news of all, the fact that they're now stopping sharing of intelligence.
So why now, is that the worst news of all? I'm curious.
Because you have a situation of, I'm going to use the same example, a person drowning in the ocean. He's lost his lifeline, but now you've turned off the light in the lighthouse, and he has no way to know which way to turn. Mm-hmm. That is very, very significant. And the other aspect of this that is really, really troubling is the fact that Ukraine is going to lose its weapons. This is probably not going to have a great effect on the front. I've been talking to people who have direct contact with people on the front. The front is going to be maintained. The problem is with the civilian population. When Ukraine runs out of Patriot missiles and other anti-missile systems, it's going to create a situation where civilians, innocent people in away from the front, are going to suffer tremendously. And that seems counter to what President Trump has said. He has indicated he wants peace. He doesn't want innocent civilians to die. It's going to have exactly the opposite effect.
Yeah. What do you say to folks who say this was simply a negotiation tactic by President Trump to get the Ukrainians to agree to peace in a swift way? What's your response to that?
2 months ago, without any of these details, I may have said that's a plausible explanation. Today, I don't believe it. As an attorney with 40 years experience, when I hear somebody who wants to be a mediator, as President Trump suggested he wants to be, he does not appear to be an honest broker. As a mediator, you don't take one party and beat them up and then hand them over on a platter to the other side. If there was equal treatment, if he had done something that, for example, increased the sanctions on Russia, then I could see that there is equal pressure on both sides. I have yet to hear him say to his friend, President Putin, stop the bombing, stop the rockets. He hasn't done that. And interestingly, he has done nothing to deal with North Korea. Remember, North Korea has, 50,000 troops in Ukraine today? And they're also supplying Russia with artillery shells. And if President Trump has such a great relationship with the North Korean dictator, why doesn't he pick up the phone and say, stop it? That hasn't happened.
We are welcoming your comments this hour. You can email studio2@whyy.org or call 888-477-9499. Matt says, I think it's disgusting talking about the U.S. pivot here. Ukraine gave up its nuclear weapons in 1994 at our request. We told them they wouldn't need them, that we would protect them from Russia. Apparently, we don't live up to our word. Andrew, before we move to the rest of the panel, I want to ask you about your personal experiences with Ukrainian soldiers who have come back from the front and back from the fighting. What have you taken away from those experiences? What can you share with us that helps illustrate what this war has truly been like?
I work as a volunteer with Revived Soldiers Ukraine. They have been bringing wounded soldiers from Ukraine since 2014, because remember, the war really started 10 years ago. And every single one of these individuals is stoic, is a patriot, wants to go back, and they do go back. Every single one of them, with the exception of a blind individual that I met that simply cannot contribute in any meaningful fashion on the front, they all go back. Some take up arms, some assist in training, some assist in rehabilitation of other soldiers. We're talking about individuals who are extremely, extremely difficult, in difficult conditions. They're amputees, they're double amputees. And I have to say, the folks at Penn Orthopedics and Wills Eye Hospital deserve a real shout out here, because mm-hmm. they've been absolutely wonderful in the treatments they've provided. But the folks go back, they want to go back, they want to fight as much as they can, and they won't stop.
Yeah. What has kept that resolve going quickly, yeah.
It's 300 years of fighting Russian oppression. We can go back in time and look at the history between Russia and Ukraine going all the way back. We can go back to the World War I. We can go back to World War II. We can go back to the invasion of Crimea. Every single time, there's always an attempt to take back freedom. You can go back to the Holodomor, which is probably the largest single calamity the world has known that is not really discussed. Millions and millions of people were starved to death. Why? Because they were Ukrainians. They wanted to be wiped out. The language was wiped out. Everything, literature, complete censorship.
You're describing centuries of imperial resistance. Yeah. That's baked into the resolve of the Ukrainian people.
Exactly.
And I want to widen this a little bit. And I guess we want to do this in stages, right? We want to talk first about this conflict and then also about what America's position should be in the world moving forward. So in terms of this conflict, Dominic Tierney, professor of political science at Swarthmore College, what do you see as America's options moving forward? And what do you see as the correct path moving forward?
Well, it was Lenin who once said that there are decades where nothing happens, and then there are sometimes weeks where decades happen. And it does seem like the first few weeks of the Trump administration have been in that second category, where it almost feels like he has taken a wrecking ball to decades of American national security policy. Structures that have been built since World War II, assumptions that have been built since World War II, based around our alliances, respect for democracy and human rights and institutions, not always living up to that those ideals, but still a meaningful global order, and that this is now being threatened and potentially destroyed. So what would I like to see happen is the United States play a critical role in creating a just and lasting peace in Ukraine. And the number one impediment to that is Russia. It was Russia that invaded Ukraine. I mean, we can talk about the backstory if you like, but it was primarily Putin's responsibility, and Putin is the number one obstacle to a peace deal. So my concern is that the Trump administration's policies have essentially taken away all of our leverage with Putin by already giving away the farm before the United States even starts negotiating. So,
in what specific way have we done that?
Well, think about what Moscow would like here. Moscow would love to see the United States take away our intelligence that we give to Ukraine, would love to see us stop arms to Ukraine, would love to see the United States talk about pulling its forces out of parts of Eastern Europe. All of those things have either happened or apparently are on the table before we start negotiating. So if you are Putin in this negotiation, what is your incentive to make any concessions whatsoever to the Ukrainians? You have a new president in the White House who is your wildest dream come true. And if you are Russia, the incentive structure that we have laid out is simply to apply more and more and more pressure, to demand more and more and more from Ukraine, and not offer anything. So I hope that this is all part of a incredibly clever negotiation strategy from the Trump administration. And there are some smart people in the administration, and I wish that I'm wrong. But what I'm seeing so far is an administration that is giving away a lot of its leverage before we even really begin the negotiations.
They're not rope-a-doping Russia.
You know, there are these ideas that Trump is not crazy, but he's crazy like a fox, and perhaps we're trying to cleverly split Putin from China as part of a very clever sort
of 4D chess,
7D chess situation here. And it is true to say, again, I don't want to make this too partisan, that Trump quickly got helped engineer a deal between the Israelis and Hamas that got some of the hostages released. I don't know if Harris could have got that deal as quickly as Trump did. Not that peace is really on the horizon there either. Yeah. But nevertheless, this kind of shock and awe diplomacy and let's shake things up can get results. But, basic negotiation logic in the case of Ukraine would say that Putin does not have an incentive to make the concessions that will be necessary for a just and lasting peace.
Yeah, I want to bring Justin Logan, Director of Defense and Foreign Policy Studies at Cato Institute, into the conversation. Justin, you heard, you know, Dominic talk about this. Your take on the Trump administration's strategy with regard to bringing peace and ending this war in Ukraine.
Well, I would go back to the Oval Office eruption last Friday, if I may. And I think that we're eliding that there was a very serious disagreement there. The dispute that erupted and sort of snowballed was about whether any diplomacy with Russia could be trusted without U.S. security guarantees. And the Trump administration has been quite clear for a long time that it has no interest in fighting Russia over Ukraine, or indeed in threatening to fight Russia over Ukraine. And President Zelensky interjected to point out, reasonably, that Russia has violated agreements with Ukraine over the years. And the fight that ensued, you know, people were talking about, was Zelensky swearing under his breath, or had J.D. Vance laid a trap for Zelensky? I think we did, the debate itself did a real disservice to what is fundamentally a disagreement. President Zelensky does not want to stop the war under any circumstances without American security guarantees. The Trump administration has said, smartly, in my view, that we have no interest in providing U.S. security guarantees to Ukraine, or indeed security guarantees as a so-called tripwire for European forces that may be so-called peacekeepers.
And why is that smart in your estimation?
Because the president previous and this president have demonstrated both rhetorically and in their actions that the United States will not fight Russia over Ukraine. President Joe Biden said, we're not going to do that. It would be World War III. He revealed that he would not do it when Russia invaded on February 24th, 2022. President Trump has said the same thing. We will not put U.S. troops in Ukraine to fight Russia. So the idea that we would make a paper commitment via NATO or some other mechanism to do what we have revealed we don't believe we have an interest to do is a form of madness, in my view.
Let me bring in a caller now. This is Folaji from South Jersey on line two, who has a take, I believe, on Republicans' attitude toward this conflict. Folaji, you're on Studio Two. What is your question or comment?
Thanks for having me, guys. I think, you know, it's kind of like I just woke up one day and we switched sides from Ukraine to Russia's side. And I'm just curious as to all the Democrats, I mean, all the Republicans that were supporting us, supporting Ukraine, all of a sudden, because Trump is now in, have switched sides. They all can't feel that what he's doing is right. So I'm just kind of curious, why is nobody speaking up on the Republican side?
Let me put that to you, Justin Logan. Do you think there has been sort of a genuine policy reversal within the Republican Party, or are they hiding their true intentions by going along with the Trump-Vance line on all of this?
So presidents and even presidential candidates have a certain gravitational force in American politics such that, you know, lower ranking party officials, much less, you know, pundits on television or something, tend to follow the leader. And there's a certain element of that that's driving this. But I also would point out that there's a certain amount of frustration, right? The war has been going in the wrong direction since the fall of 2022. And, you know, Americans have been known to get tired with their own wars when they don't go well, which unfortunately has happened quite frequently in recent years. And so I think there's a sense of exhaustion. There's a sense that the war is not going in the right direction, that it's costly, that it's running risks for Americans. And I think that Trump's, you know, interventions on all of these fronts has deepened that, no doubt, maybe more than the wonky arguments themselves have. But I think, you know, this war is looking more dubious over time because it's become more dubious over time.
Yeah, I want to read a comment from Hope, who says, I think it's the right thing to do. It's a disaster and needs to end. I want to ask you this question, Andrew. How long do you think America was supposed to support Ukraine in this effort? Because the numbers, the amount of money that has been spent, and many Americans have said, we've been putting a lot of money into this war, and there is no way that Ukraine can win. So I want your thoughts. How long was America supposed to support Ukraine in this? And even if it didn't end now, like where was the end going to be?
Well, obviously, we can't predict the future. Wars can sometimes end overnight, depending on circumstances. But you have a situation where I disagree with the prior speaker, where he says the war is going in the wrong direction. Let's take a look at this. Ukraine, without a navy, has managed to basically drive off the Russian naval fleet all the way to the eastern side of the Black Sea using sea drones that look like little motorboats. Mm-hmm. They've been able to do that. They've been able to hold a front which is, 1,200 miles long against an onslaught using simply devised drones that drop explosives. They've been successful in doing that. And let's remind ourselves of what the previous administration and others have said. We're going to support Ukraine as long as it takes. And what exactly does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean that we wait until Ukraine simply evaporates? It will never evaporate, because we know from history it won't evaporate. But we Ukrainians feel that they have never been given the right amount of support. It's been just enough that you stand in one position, but they never got the extra bullet. They never got the extra tank. They never got the extra intelligence that was needed to push back. And quite frankly, Ukrainians demonstrated in 2023 a very successful counterattack. And had they had continued support in that regard, I think they would have been successful.
Let me read in a few emails on similar themes here. Zia says, Ukraine is the sacrificial lamb for now, but make no mistake about it, this is also America. Russia wants our democracy to fail. Warren says, in my view, President Trump should receive an international award, the Neville Chamberlain Memorial Umbrella, to recognize his efforts to repeat the actions of Britain in 1938 that, of course, preceded World War II. And there are a few other emails on this same theme, basically people looking at the situation in Ukraine and saying, if this domino falls, Russia will be emboldened, and other malignant actors in the world will be emboldened. Do you believe, Dominic Tierney, that that is a reasonable assumption to make? Or could this be isolated to this one conflict?
So I don't think that if Russia achieves a victory in Ukraine, that it's immediately going to just march across Western Europe, right? It's much weaker than the Soviet Union was decades ago, and it's lost an enormous number of men and so on in the war. However, I think there would nevertheless be incredibly negative consequences of a Russian victory. First and foremost, for Ukraine itself. Imagine this fledgling democracy fighting for its life, incredibly brave soldiers, as Trump himself said. Mm-hmm. Imagine seeing Russian soldiers marching through Kyiv. This is just utterly devastating. And Russia will then look to mobilize Ukraine's resources as maybe not a new Soviet Union, but a larger entity. And if you're then Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Finland, Sweden, you are going to be very nervous about what comes next. It might not be a full-scale invasion, but you're going to see Russian aggression. What is the lesson that Taiwan takes for Chinese action there? And then there's also the United States itself. What does American politics look like if Ukraine falls to Putin's forces? You're going to see even more division and name-calling and finger-pointing about who is responsible for this, and it's further going to tear American society apart. So it's worth fighting to help the Ukrainians.
Yeah. You're saying hold the line.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we want to continue this conversation on the other side of this break. Much more to get to on this conflict, but also what America's role should be in the world moving forward with conflicts that may be similar to this in the future. So give us a call, 888-477-9499, or email studio2@whyy.org. We'll be right back. And welcome back, everybody, to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. We are talking about U.S. foreign policy, NATO, and the war in Ukraine. Our guests are Andrew Filipovich, volunteer with Revived Soldiers Ukraine, and former president of the Ukrainian American Bar Association. We also have Dominic Tierney, professor of political science at Swarthmore College, and Justin Logan, director of defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute.
And please join us from home or on YouTube. What do you think about America's foreign policy pivot under Trump? Give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org, or if you're on YouTube, a studio tuber, drop your comment right there in the chat. Justin Logan, before we sort of shift to the bigger global perspective, I want to ask what you think should be America's approach to end this war, because I think you're coming at the perspective of there's some sunk cost here and we have to accept some sort of compromise. So what should that compromise be?
Well, I think what the Trump administration has been struggling with heretofore is that, as I mentioned before, you know, Zelensky has said without U.S. security guarantees, he has no intention of ending the war. And so the loggerheads to which you then come is if Ukrainian forces are incapable of doing targeting without American intelligence, the American prerogative, by definition, has to get a lot of sway. And, you know, I mean, it's true that Ukraine is less reliant on U.S. munitions than it was, say, 2 or 3 years ago. But if the reliance is that profound, then the American, again, the American prerogative, the desire to end the war, has to have some purchase. And so I think what the Trump administration is trying to do is to sort of make clear that its willingness to do what the Biden administration did, which is simply throw money and weapons at the problem and hope for the best, is over.
I want to read this comment from Lauren on YouTube, who says, America should support freedom and democracy. As we cease to do so, in my opinion, we aren't the same nation anymore. I want to zoom out a little bit, because America has been sort of the world police, a moral authority, the leader when it comes to culture and what is right. And we've paid a price for that. We've been subsidizing security in many countries around the world. And it seems like the Trump administration has a different philosophy. What is going to be the cost of that, Dominic?
So, I mean, first of all, I think that, you know, the Trump administration does have a point in certain respects. It is true that Europeans have relied on Americans for their security for many decades and have sort of lived in a kind of a dream state where they get free security from America, cheap goods from China, cheap energy from Russia, and they can sort of live in their nice welfare state. Well, they're waking up from that dream right now. And in some ways, that is a healthy process, right? And Europeans should be taking more responsibility for their security and boosting their military spending. And there's no reason why American taxpayers should be entirely footing the bill. However, in a wider sense, you know, the United States, since 1945, for all of its sins, for all of its failures, has played a critical role in producing a measure of global stability and global order, and protection for democracy, some protection for human rights, free trade, and crucially, a strong network of alliances.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And this has been an enormous, you know, power maximizer, influence maximizer for the U.S. So I am personally shocked to see, you know, Trump going after Canada. And going
after about with the tariffs, yeah.
Yeah, and with language of, you know, we're going to annex Canada, which yeah. the Trudeau and other Canadian leaders say. I mean, it sounds fantastical, but they're taking it quite seriously. I mean, if you're Canadian now, you see the United States as a threat to your national security. And the people in Europe that are most upset about this, they're not the European lefties who have long complained about American cowboy diplomacy and so The people who are most upset are the Europeans who have long defended the United States, who have said America is a force for good in the world.
Yeah.
And they turn around and look at Trump and they think, why would you attack your friends and your allies?
Yeah.
So let me read this email from JJ, who says, under Trump, America operates like our major adversaries. Every decision is transactional. And I guess my concern would be, Justin Logan, is that if America pulls back from the world, what every other country around the world does is they look at what happens in Ukraine and they say, we have got to arm ourselves. India, Pakistan, let's up the nuclear game. Taiwan, let's raise our military. Whatever any country that's in a potentially adverse situation says, America can't keep order anymore. Let's arm ourselves. And that ultimately leads to a much bigger conflict. Why wouldn't that happen, Justin Logan?
So I don't think U.S. policy in Ukraine one way or the other will bear on the India-Pakistan dispute. I think that there's a tendency to want to sublimate what are, in fact, very disparate conflicts under whatever the policy issue du jour is. I have a somewhat different view of the track record of the post-war U.S. foreign policy, and indeed pre-World War II U.S. foreign policy. I think it's been one of utter ruthlessness. I think at times we've been a great source of global instability. If you look at the American track record across Latin America, in the Middle East, there's a tremendous amount of carnage and destruction in our wake. So it's true that after World War II, we saw Western Europe in ruins and a Soviet Union that looked much more powerful than the combined countries of Western Europe. And so we stepped in and said, we don't want one country to dominate Western Europe. But in the contemporary era, Vladimir Putin's Russia is not Kaiser Wilhelm's Germany, it's not Adolf Hitler's Germany, and it's not Joe Stalin's Soviet Union. So in fact, to push the responsibility for European defense back onto the shoulders of European taxpayers from American taxpayers is exactly the right initiative. And indeed, you know, Trump's style is combative and many things that think tank dorks like me generally don't go in for. But if you look at what the results have been, you have Ursula von der Leyen loosening the Stability and Growth Pact to say there's going to be 800 billion euros in monies freed up for
European about mobilization among the EU defense. Countries to up their defense game. But let me just push back real quick. So I guess you rightfully point out that the so-called Pax Americana post-World War II has not been all roses. There's been plenty of conflict over the world. But I think a lot of people say when America has operated as the world's cop, as the great hegemon, there has been less conflict and there's been less of an attitude that everyone should serve as our vassals, and instead they should serve as our partners. Do you believe that's just not the case, Justin Logan?
No, I think that if you look at the North Atlantic Treaty Organization over its lifespan, the United States was extremely transactional and self-interested since before the Washington Treaty was in fact signed. We lawyered the treaty within an inch of its life to provide ourselves off-ramps in Article 5, in Article 9, to ensure that we wouldn't automatically be committed to war should the balloon go up. We were very sharp-elbowed with the French in the 1960s. And so I don't think that this sort of liberal world order rhetoric that you hear where I am in Washington all the time describes reality. We've been a very forceful, very self-seeking, and very transactional country for a long time. Sometimes we've dramatically misconstrued our own interests. No, but I don't think that this the purity of our intentions has been all that high.
So Trump's just bringing to the surface what's already been happening, is what you're saying.
I mean, look, the Biden administration said Ukraine is on an irreversible path to NATO membership. At the same time they were saying that publicly, they were working assiduously behind the scenes to ensure that Ukraine would not be provided a path into NATO. Now, to me, that's the height of disingenuousness. It's lying. And you heard Zelensky in January say, you know, I'm starting to wonder whether the Americans ever wanted us into NATO at all, to which my response is, that's an absolutely reasonable thing for you to do. And I think what Trump is doing is just saying, we're not doing this, and everybody can make their own decisions about what they want to do when we don't do it.
Yeah, I want to just remind our listeners at home, our question for you today is, what do you think about America's foreign policy pivot under Trump? The number is 888-477-9499. The email is studio2@whyy.org. And if you're watching on YouTube, you can drop your comment in the chat. We have a bunch of callers on the line, so I want to get to some of them. We have Adrian from Elkins Park on the line. Adrian, you're on Studio 2. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that earlier in the discussion, it was said that everybody feels that Russia is too strong for us to defeat, and therefore we should just cave and let him take a portion of or all of Ukraine. Well, the problem with that appeasement policy is that presumably then, if Putin decides he then wants to take the Baltics, he'll do the same thing, and we'll do the same thing. So he'll just walk in. And then what happens when he says, oh, well, let me try Poland next? And if we continue with this approach of appeasement every time he sets foot forward, because we're all afraid of him, then how do we stop him taking the whole of Europe? Because that's ultimately what could happen.
Yeah.
Thank you, Adrian.
Thank you, Adrian. And that's a lot of the fears that folks have. Do you have any comment on that?
Sure. I think the caller is certainly onto something. I mean, the liberal international order, as Justin says, there's a lot of myth to it, right? The idea that it was some sort of rosy generosity from America and so on. I mean, there was a lot of tough-minded bargaining that went into every single piece of it, and that's correct. And a lot of American military misadventures, think of Iraq or Afghanistan or Vietnam and so on, but you can go too far in that critique. This is a meaningful structure that the United States created and has led. And we know it's meaningful because the Europeans are shocked by what Trump has done. If it was always this, ruthless transactional system, then the Europeans would not be shocked. Yeah. But they are shocked. The only thing worse than American leadership is going to be the absence of American leadership.
And that's what our next caller wants to talk about. We have Michael from Kennett Square on the line. Michael, what's your question or comment?
Well, very simply, assuming America is out of NATO, are NATO armed forces, could they today beat Russia in a conventional war?
And that's
Russia's military ability has been severely depleted by, what they've expended so far. So are we in a position now to take Russia militarily out of it?
Thank you.
Ignoring the nuclear option.
Yeah, thank you so much. That's Michael from Kennett Square. And Justin, your comments on that, because if America sort of backs out and sort of, removes all support from NATO at some point, would NATO be able to survive and take on Russia?
Sure. I mean, there's an interesting two-step that people in Washington do here, which is to say, on the one hand, with enough support from outside, Ukraine can defeat Russia outright. And many of those people say in the next breath that Russia is a hegemonic threat to continental Europe. Well, to my mind, you can believe the first or you can believe the second, but you can't believe them both, right? A Russia that struggles to bully Ukraine, fighting on its own with outside support, cannot be a hegemonic threat to Poland or Germany or France, which has nuclear weapons and on down the line. Or you could believe that Russia, in fact, is somehow a hegemonic threat, but then you have to explain why it hasn't defeated Ukraine after 3 years of brutal warfare. So I think that the Europeans have a learned helplessness here, right? And the American policymakers have encouraged it for decades, right? When the Europeans around the turn of the millennium tried to get themselves together and do common foreign and security policies or policies together outside of NATO, the Americans came in and squashed it. Because we like to be the lodestar in Europe. And I think that was a tremendously stupid and short-sighted policy. But if you look at what Europe has the capability to do, they have 10 times Russia's GDP, they have 4 or 5 times Russia's population, and depending on how you count, 2 or 3 times Russian military spending already without the United States. So if some of those efforts were rationalized and improved and even expanded on slightly, I think that, preventing Russia from dominating Europe is not that demanding a problem.
So you're saying basically that Russia is not as strong as as everybody in the world thinks they are, and that they probably won't be able to do all the things that people fear that they will be able to do.
I think it's certainly not as strong. It's not strong enough to poise a threat to Poland, much less Germany.
All right. So we're coming up on the end here. Mm-hmm. But I guess I want to get some closing thoughts from you, Andrew. You've been sitting back listening to a lot of this. And then you have the experience of having personal relationships with people on the ground there. What do you think Ukrainians make of this entire back and forth, this sort of big picture conversation about America's role in the world?
I think Ukrainians are disenchanted. I think Ukrainians have always looked at the United States as that shining light on the hill, the beacon that guides everybody towards freedom. And I think if we look back in history, recent history, let's look at the end of World War II, right? Everybody wanted peace. But what did that peace entail? There was a line drawn through Europe. And what did that line do? It created the Iron Curtain. It created 50 years of communism in Eastern European countries that Stalin promised would have free elections. It turned into oppression in the Soviet Union. And now it looks like we might be having another line drawn through Europe. Ukrainians certainly don't want to see a Yalta II.
Yeah, so hearts are sinking as they hear this conversation in Ukraine, feeling like basically we're going to be in the same position we were in 1950, 1955, 1960.
Absolutely. But there's always hope.
There is hope.
Well, thank you all for being here today. And there were so many people that commented that we could not work mm-hmm. into the show, and we do apologize as well. Always. But thank you all for your interest in this topic. And of course, we'll continue to talk about this. Let me thank our guests again. Andrew Filipovich, volunteer with Revive Soldiers Ukraine and former president of the Ukrainian American Bar Association. Thank you, Andrew, for your time.
Thank you.
Dominic Tierney, professor of political science at Swarthmore. Thank you, sir, for being here.
Thank you.
And Justin Logan, director of defense and foreign policy studies at the Cato Institute. Thank you for joining us remotely.
My pleasure.
And thank you to everybody who commented or emailed or called today. And thank you to our producers, Debbie Bilder, Paige Marie Bessler, and Andreas Copes. Thanks to Mike Schiffler, our visual producer, and to Al Banks and Tina Calique, who engineered today's show. Our executive producer is Kevin McCory. From Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. We will talk with you tomorrow.